I'm Laura Murphy Oates, and this is The Full Story.
It was around 2 in the morning. I had some pretty extreme back pain going on, and I thought it's kind of felt a lot like strong period pain.
This is Sonia. It's February 2020, several months into the worst bushfire season Australia has seen in a very long time.
So I didn't think too much of it. There's a lot of sort of discomfort in pregnancy, and so I was just kind of up and walking around a little bit and thought, I'll go back to sleep. And then I couldn't sleep through it. It was very painful. By about 3 a.m., I decided maybe I'd call the hospital, which was nearby, and that I might just walk up and have a little check and see how things were going. They said, maybe wait an hour and walk on up and see how... Well, they didn't tell me to walk. I just walked on up. And so I arrived at about 4:30 at the hospital, and pretty soon after that, they said, your baby's coming today.
She's just realised she's having her baby 6 weeks early.
I think I went into not a complete state of shock, but I was sort of went into this kind of overdrive where I thought, well, there's so many things I haven't organised for this. I haven't finished working. I haven't sort of gotten the room ready for the baby. It's really early. And then, of course, my concern turned to, is my baby going to be okay? What does this mean? Of course, I hadn't planned to or even thought about having a premature baby before. So, I just started to wonder what it was all going to mean.
Sonia is not the only pregnant person who spent that summer inhaling smoke and then experienced complications. We know quite a bit about the effects that air pollution can have on human health, but researchers are only just starting to understand how this affects a pregnancy. Today, how bushfire smoke is impacting pregnancy. It's Monday, the 1st of March. I'll actually get you to intro yourself and the title that you'd like in the podcast first, actually.
So, Isabel Odeberg, I am a journalist, writer and media communications professional within the not-for-profit space.
And what's your connection to this topic?
I'm writing a book called Hard to Bear, and it's about pregnancy loss, specifically early pregnancy loss. I've actually had 7 pregnancy losses myself, so it's a topic that I'm particularly interested in unpacking. And while I was researching the book, I started coming across research studies about bushfire smoke and pregnancy and air pollution, and basically I saw how little it was being talked about, so I decided to take a closer look.
Sure. Well, I'm Sonia, and I am a food and travel writer.
So as part of looking into that story, I spoke to women who had been pregnant or lost pregnancies during the 2019-2020 bushfire season, and one of those was Sonia.
I spend most of my time travelling around the world and eating, which I obviously haven't done any of during this COVID period. I'm married to my high school boyfriend. We've been together for nearly 17 years. And I'm a mum to Frida, who's almost a year old now.
Sonia was pregnant with her baby during that particularly intense bushfire season, and her pregnancy had progressed fairly uneventfully.
I was a real stickler with pregnancy, so I didn't touch any alcohol, I didn't eat anything that wasn't recommended, didn't do any kind of activity that wasn't recommended to pregnant women. So I went sort of on the strict end of the spectrum, and so I was sort of changing my lifestyle to suit the whole situation.
And about 6 weeks before her due date, she went into premature labour. It was February 21st and Freddie came early.
And so I laboured for about, I don't know, maybe 14 hours or something like that. So I guess that's where things got a little bit different than a usual birth.
So 6 weeks early, what does that mean for a baby?
A baby being born prematurely, which is anywhere before 37 weeks of gestation, can create a lot of health challenges. The most common and high-risk challenge is that the lungs aren't fully developed and they need assistance to breathe. That's often why when you see a baby in special care, they have tubes coming from everywhere. And often they have to be fed by a tube as well.
So once Frida was born, they had to take her away straight away. So she needed to be resuscitated because she wasn't breathing properly. So from there, she was taken into the neonatal intensive care unit, the NICU ward. She was in a humidity crib and she had a CPAP or breathing mask on and lots of different monitors and cords sort of coming off her and a cannula and all these little things. And being a tiny baby, she was just covered in cords and lights for jaundice and all of that sort of stuff. So that was really tough.
For anyone listening who doesn't, like who can't picture that, can you describe how big she was? Like, could you fit her in one hand or could, you know, like how big would you describe her as?
She was so tiny. It was almost, a lot of people tell me that when their baby is born, they almost look familiar or they have this kind of, they can sort of see whose side of the family is in them. Freddie was really, really little to the point where she almost didn't look like a baby. She looked just like a really, really tiny sort of creature almost. That's a terrible thing to say, but she was just this little red sort of skinny thing. And I mean, she was just, as they say in the NICU ward, she was undercooked. So she just wasn't ready to be out yet. So her legs and arms were probably the width of two of my fingers together or something like that. So really little.
How long were Sonia and Freddie in hospital for?
Sonia was in hospital for 2 nights, but Freddie was there for 2 weeks.
So she was in the NICU at first and then a sort of middle range of care and then the special care, which they sort of refer to as the fattening farm, where they're sort of coming off a lot of the monitors and getting a lot healthier and ready to come home.
Does Sonia know why she had a premature baby?
There are lots of reasons that you might go into labour early. High blood pressure, diabetes, smoking, incompetent cervix. There are all sorts of reasons that you may bring a baby into the world, or that baby may decide they're coming into the world early. Sonia had no particular risk factors that would have resulted in a premature birth like the one that happened for Freddie. But when she was talking to her doctor, the doctor raised the idea that bushfire smoke may actually be a contributor to the premature birth or potentially even the cause.
He said to me, look, we don't know why this has happened. Sometimes it's an infection, sometimes it's just a bit of a mystery. In this case, you know, there's a theory going around that the bushfire smoke could have had something to do with it, and they couldn't say definitively that that was the cause, but that's one suggestion. And then on a later date, I was talking to my GP and she said the same thing. She said that they've been seeing some more low weight babies and premature babies during that time frame, and that there were some ideas going around that it could have been bushfire smoke related.
Did you know anyone else who had a similar experience?
I knew some and have come to know since about 10 women who've had premature and low weight births who were pregnant during the worst of the bushfire smoke.
So it sounds like Sonia isn't alone. Do we actually know how many women experience births like hers after the bushfires?
Well, what's interesting is that the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare did release a report around the short-term health effects of the bushfires that took place around 2019-20, and there was no pregnancy or adverse pregnancy outcomes included in that report. That report was centred primarily on respiratory issues like asthma and things like that. My understanding is that the maternity outcomes haven't been released from that period yet, but it's something that we definitely need to look into if and when that is made available.
So I remember this time pretty well. It was the first time that I've really gone and looked up what the air quality was around me. I've never had to do that before in my life. I'm wondering if you can break down exactly how that air quality affects our health.
A lot of people have probably heard of PM 2.5 and PM 10, and they are different forms of particulate matter. We're hearing more about them as bushfire seasons around the world gain intensity. But you also get those particles in the air when there's lots of cars around. There are lots of busy main roads that are actually far higher in pollution than the minimum that you would want in order to maintain levels of health or environmental cleanliness. good. All right, so I'm going to kick off. I'm just wondering to kick off whether you could just briefly sort of introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about the area of research that you specialise in and how you come to be talking to us today.
Okay, so I'm Sarah Robertson. I work at the University of Adelaide. I'm the director of an institute here called the Robinson Research Institute.
I spoke to Professor Sarah Robertson from the University of Adelaide. Her research looks at biomedical origins of pregnancy and fertility disorders in women.
And especially we're interested in how environmental factors interact with our biology to influence the immune response.
And she went into more detail about how bad air quality actually affects our bodies.
So the problem with these tiny particles, especially the PM2.5, is that they're so small that they penetrate our lungs very easily and then can cross into the bloodstream and circulate through the body. This means they can finish up in all the different tissues of the body and stimulate a range of adverse health consequences.
What does Sarah mean when she says adverse health consequences? What do these particles do to our bodies?
Particulate matter activates an inflammation response in our body, which is basically our body trying to protect itself from foreign substances. And an inflammation response is never ideal in anyone. However, for pregnant women and women trying to get pregnant, it is a really big problem.
Inflammation in pregnancy is just really problematic because the mother's body has to tolerate the implanting embryo and the fetus and can't reject it.
So implantation of the fetus is when the fetus actually attaches itself to the wall of the uterus and begins to grow.
If the immune system is activating a immune rejection response, that leads to problems with the way the placenta develops. And that's one of the major causes of miscarriage.
So from what Sarah says, it sounds like it's possible that bushfire smoke could prevent pregnancy in the first place.
Definitely air pollution and bushfire smoke could be preventing pregnancy or the viability of pregnancy. We don't talk about miscarriage broadly, so we don't know how common it is to miscarry during bushfire events or during periods of heavy air pollution. But certainly we know that air pollution, well, it reduces sperm quality. It also reduces a female's capacity to ovulate a healthy egg. We know that sperm quality reduction can play a significant role in miscarriage and recurrent miscarriage, and that inflammation response can also increase the risk of miscarriage as well.
What about for women who are further along in their pregnancy? Do we know what impact smoke has on them?
There haven't been a huge number of studies into this particular issue. We're still at a phase where we're learning as much as we possibly can, but there was a study done in the US in Colorado, which I discussed with Professor Robertson, which showed a link pretty definitively between smoke exposure and preterm birth.
The Colorado study showed very clearly that there was an impact of exposure to bushfire smoke right over the course of pregnancy on the likelihood of preterm birth in particular, and in also exposure in the second trimester, especially on fetal growth restriction. So the way the baby is developing and reflecting how well, I guess, that child is likely to be set up for life after birth.
So what Sarah is saying here is not only can babies be born prematurely, like Freddie, but their growth can actually be impacted in the womb. And babies that are born premature or small for their gestational age are at risk of chronic disease throughout their lives.
So we know basically that smoke has an impact on the development of babies in utero, but is smoke the only factor here? Could there be other things that are driving this change?
Absolutely, that's a possibility. The environment affects us in so many different ways, and there are so many factors that could be contributing. For example, nutrition.
Exposure to endocrine disrupting chemicals, the plasticizing chemicals that we're all exposed to every day.
Microplastics have been shown to cross the placenta, as has particulate matter.
Age-related issues and metabolic function more broadly.
Of course, women choosing to delay having children, and so the age of the people trying to conceive. And I should add actually that despite a belief that men's ability to procreate isn't affected by their age, it is. Sperm quality does decline. So there are lots of different reasons that we may be experiencing spikes in infertility, but there's no question that this is one of the factors that's affecting what we're seeing.
They're happening too fast to be only accountable by genetic causes. So while genes contribute, it's really obvious that there are environmental factors as well. The challenge is to figure out how the air pollution is contributing and the weight of its contribution compared to these other factors.
So is there anything else we need to know about smoke and how it could be impacting women and pregnant women and their babies?
Pollutants in the air can change the way that our DNA functions. So it's an area of study called epigenetics. DNA makes up who we are and how we function, how our bodies function.
Epigenetics is a mechanism that changes the structure of our DNA, not so much the code itself, but the layer on top of the code that gives the instructions about what genes should be expressed when and where.
What this does is it doesn't change the fundamental makeup of our DNA, but it does change the way that our DNA functions.
And it's a really critical way that environmental factors seem to affect our biology and our health. Now, the thing about pregnancy and especially about fertility is that the earlier you go back in life, and especially in the very early embryo, just after the time of conception, the embryo is very vulnerable to epigenetic changes. In fact, it's designed the biology, the developmental biology, to operate that way. It's a window of opportunity for information to be collected from the environment and layered into the embryo to, in the best case scenario, give it a great chance of developing to match the environment and have a healthy chance at life after birth. But when incorrect epigenetic information and harmful impacts, environmental impacts, are put into the DNA of the embryo, that can change the way it develops into a fetus and a placenta in the uterus, and it can really set the course of a different developmental pathway.
And there are lots of different ways that our DNA can be affected in this way. It's not just pollutants. There's studies now to show that like really, really high levels of stress, people coming back from war, things like that, the way their DNA functions can be changed.
And what does that lead to, our DNA changing the way that it functions?
We know that epigenetic changes can have a raft of adverse health outcomes. For example, it can affect someone later in life with things like cardiovascular disease. And if those changes are made while you're in the womb, that's going to be an issue for the rest of your life.
And that's really worrying. So, you know, because you can't go back from that. Once those epigenetic changes are made, that individual is stuck with that for the rest of that child's life, and also will be imparting that information to his or her children through what we call intergenerational transmission of epigenetic impact. So you're really shifting the change of direction of development, not just of one generation, but the future generations from now on through these adverse exposures.
So Izzy, let me get this straight. Breathing in polluted air, whether it's bushfire smoke or car exhaust, it can affect the body of a pregnant woman and the implantation of an embryo. It can affect male sperm, and it can change the way that our DNA functions, which can be passed from generation to generation. Have I understood this? This seems like a lot.
Absolutely, it's a lot, isn't it? It's pretty full on.
Next. Are pregnant women being told about the risks of this air pollution? Hey, Laura Murphy Yotes here. Just a quick message for any new listeners to Full Story. If you like what you hear, you should subscribe. You can find us by searching for Full Story on Spotify, Apple, Google, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Thanks. So Isabel, from everything that you've told me and that Sarah's said as well, it seems like we are finding out a lot about how smoke exposure affects pregnant women, and pregnant women should be told about this and, you know, be able to limit their exposure to polluted air at certain times. Did we see that during the bushfire season? Did we see warnings from health authorities for pregnant women?
No, we didn't. I mean, there were bits and pieces here and there, but nothing substantial.
I do remember looking around to see if there was any information about anything I could do to make sure I didn't experience any harm, I suppose. And I didn't really find anything. I did see that pregnant women were potentially more sensitive to bushfire smoke, but I didn't really have a grasp of what that meant and what I could do to help that situation.
Was it just kind of like one line in a page of information on a website?
It was basically, just one line in a page of information. And I mean, I had regular checkups with my GP and midwives at the hospital as well, and I didn't receive any information from any kind of health professional about whether I should be concerned or doing anything in particular.
What about Sarah, as someone who studies in this area? What does she say about the level of information that's given out?
Sarah was really concerned by the lack of information being given to the public and especially to pregnant people.
So when I was in Canberra and seeing the level of air pollution to do with the smoke and that bushfire in January 2020, I just couldn't believe it. And thinking, this is just so dreadful. And I'd go online and see what I could find about women thinking about conceiving and women who might already be pregnant and what kind of advice was out there. And there was nothing. So it was really worrying. I mean, there was lots of advice for people with asthma and cardiovascular conditions, for elderly people, but nothing specifically for pregnant women. So it did really worry me. And that's what motivated me to kind of pull some of the evidence together and find out more about this.
Is there a reason why these health authorities didn't give out stronger health advice about the smoke?
Look, it's clear that we need more research about bushfire smoke and what it can do to pregnant women. That could be part of the problem, doctors being unsure about what to advise. But that lack of research is a problem in and of itself. We need this done, and we need it done yesterday. But also, Sarah does say that there's potentially an element of paternalism here. And, you know, I'd say that there's a risk that if we tell pregnant women, there's a perceived risk that if we tell pregnant women about this, they'll become almost hysterical.
You know, there's a worry that somehow there's going to be some sort of overreaction, but I think that women really don't buy that paternalistic attitude. If there is evidence and knowledge, most women are capable of understanding it to a level and then making decisions about how to apply that to their own life.
Hmm. Do you agree with Sarah?
Yeah, I do agree with Sarah. The medical profession can be patronising to women. I think by not telling women about these risks, it takes the power out of women's hands to make these decisions for themselves, and not just for themselves, but for their unborn children. It's obscene that this information wasn't made available to pregnant women in the last bushfire season. We certainly know enough about this risk to be able to tell people about it and warn them, and we owe that to women.
Living in Sydney during the bushfires, the sky was, you know, blazing orange, and I walked to and from the train station to work, so I was outdoors quite a lot. And yeah, I was definitely concerned about whether that could cause any harm to both me and my baby. I felt a little let down because, especially when I was doing my best to make sure I was doing all the right things, and I would never have smoked a cigarette, but here I am breathing in all of this bushfire smoke and other pollutants in the air, I suppose. And so I guess that's a pretty scary thing. And had I been made aware, or had I been told to be careful about these things, I certainly would have been.
If someone close to you, whether it was yourself or a daughter or a niece or a cousin or something, was planning to get pregnant now and they lived near a main road, or they were carrying during a bushfire event or anything like that, what advice would you give them?
So my daughter is currently 28 weeks pregnant, and she lives pretty close to a main road in North Melbourne, and she's having a test today, and I'm just thinking I need to remind her to get on the air pollution apps. So the advice I would give to people in my family is to kind of get educated about it and to find out what you can about using air pollution apps and monitoring the level of air pollution every day. And on days where it really isn't great, or where there is bushfire smoke, do what you can to avoid that exposure. One of the best things you can do is stay inside the house, especially when the levels are really high, and see what you can do to keep the air cleaner in your house, either by sealing outside air from coming in, But also, if possible, it can be helpful for some people to use air purifying systems that take out the particles. Now, obviously, that's not for everybody, but it can be an effective choice. Or otherwise, to think about moving out of that area if that's an option for you.
I mean, there's only so much that each person can control. There's a lot at play here in terms of bushfire smoke that's going to get worse in terms of air pollution in major cities. I'm wondering how much the individual can do when these bigger issues are at play.
Look, there is only a certain amount that an individual can control. So we do need more information and we do need big policies to reduce pollution and get climate change under control immediately. But that's why people like Sarah and groups like Doctors for the Environment are pulling this research together to pressure governments to make the changes that will create healthier environments.
So Izzy, do you know how Sonia is right now and how Freddie is as well?
Freddie is apparently, I haven't had the chance to meet her, but from everything I hear, a beautiful, thriving little girl. And Sonia is loving being a mum. But that doesn't necessarily mean she isn't nervous about Freddie's future. Do you worry looking forward? I mean, there are health challenges for some, not all, babies that have visits to the NICU or who are born premature. Do you worry about health outcomes in future for your baby?
I feel like I'm certainly more sensitive to if I hear her coughing or getting coldy, I'm a little bit more sensitive than I probably would have been otherwise and a little more overcautious with taking her to the doctor because I think just having seen her in hospital for such a long time and although she's a really healthy, happy baby now, I just don't want her to have to go through anything horrible like that again.
Are you planning to have more kids? Am I allowed to ask you, has it been too much or would you do it all again?
I would do it again and I probably will have a second baby, but the experience of having a preemie baby is really tough and I think you get those extra 6 weeks of newborn life and as a lot of parents will know, that's a really tough time. And then having the kind of heartbreak at the start of leaving her in the hospital, it's definitely going to probably put a bit more space between the first and second child, I think.
That's it for today. Thanks to Isabel Odeberg for her time. You can read more from her at theguardian.com. We've put a link to her article on this on the full story page. This episode was produced by Ellen Lee Beater and Joe Koning. Our executive producers are Miles Martignoni and Gabrielle Jackson. If you liked this episode, don't forget to leave a rating or a review. Okay, catch you tomorrow.